Blaine made his way quickly to the bridge and strapped himself into the command chair. As soon as he was settled, he reached for the intercom unit. A startled midshipman Whitbread looked out of the screen from the captain's cabin. Blaine gambled. "Read it to me, mister."
Sir?
"You have the regs open to the standing orders on alien contact, don't you? Read them to me, please." Blaine remembered looking them up long ago for fun and curiosity. Most cadets did.
"Yes, sir."
Visibly, Whitbread wondered if the captain had been reading his mind, then decided that it was the captain's prerogative. This incident would start legends. "Section 4500. First contact with non-human sentient beings. Note, sentient beings are defined as creatures which employ tools and communication in purposeful behavior. Subnote, officers are cautioned to use judgment in applying this definition. The hive rat of Macassar, as an example, employs tools and communication to maintain its nest, but is not sentient. Section 1. Upon encounter with sentient non-human beings, officers will communicate the existence of such aliens to nearest fleet command. All other objectives will be considered secondary to this accomplishment. Section 2. After the objective described in Section 1 is assured, officers will attempt to establish communication with the aliens, provided, however, that in so doing, they are not authorized to risk their command unless so ordered by higher authority. Although officers will not initiate hostilities, it must be assumed that non-human sentient creatures may be hostile. Section 3. Whitbread was cut off by the final acceleration warning. Blaine nodded acknowledgement to the MIDI and settled back in his couch. The regulations weren't likely to be much use anyway. They mostly dealt with initial contact without prior warning, and here Fleet Command pretty well knew MacArthur was going out to intercept an alien vessel. Ship's gravity edged upward, slowly enough to give the crew time to adjust, a full minute to rise to 3 gravities. Blaine felt 260 kilos settling into his acceleration couch. Throughout the ship, men would be moving with the wary attention one gives to lifting weights. But it was not a crippling acceleration, not for a young man. For Barry, it would be rough, but the trader would be all right if he stayed in his G-bed. Blaine felt very much at ease in his contoured armchair. It had headrest and fingertip controls, lap board, power swiveling so that the entire bridge was in view without effort, even a personal relief tube. Warships are designed for long periods of high gravity. Blaine fiddled with his screen controls to produce a 3D graph overhead. He cut in the privacy switch to hide his doodles from the rest of the crew. Around him, the bridge officers attended to their duties. Cargill and Sailing Master Renner huddled together near the astrogation station. Midshipman Staley settled next to the helmsman, ready to assist if needed, but mostly there to learn how to handle the ship. Blaine's long fingers moved over the screen controls. A long green velocity line, a short lavender vector pointing in the opposite direction, with a small white ball between. So, the intruder had come straight from the direction of the moat and was decelerating directly into the new Cal system. And it was somewhat bigger than Earth's moon. A ship-sized object would have been a dimensionless point. A good thing Whitbread hadn't noticed that. There'd be gossip, tales to the crew, panic among the new hands. Blaine felt the metallic taste of fear himself. My God, it was big. But they'd have to have something that big, Rod muttered. 35 light-years, through normal space. There never had been a human civilization that could manage such a thing. Still, how did the Admiralty expect him to investigate it, much less intercept it? Land on it with Marines? What in Hannigan's hell was a light sail?
"Course to Bridget, sir," Sailing Master Renner announced.
Blaine snapped up from his reverie and touched his screen controls again. The ship's course appeared on his screen as a pictorial diagram below tables of figures. Rod spoke with effort.
"Approved."
Then he went back to the impossibly large object on his view screen. Suddenly he took out his pocket computer and scribbled madly across its face. Words and numbers flowed across the surface, and he nodded. Of course, light pressure could be used for propulsion. In fact, MacArthur did exactly that, using hydrogen fusion to generate photons and emitting them in an enormous spreading cone of light. A reflecting mirror could use outside light as propulsion and get twice the efficiency. Naturally, the mirror should be as large as possible and as light, and ideally it should reflect all the light that fell on it. Blaine grinned to himself. He had been nerving himself to attack a space-going planet with his half-repaired battlecruiser. Naturally, the computer had pictured an object that size as a globe. In reality, it was probably a sheet of silvered fabric thousands of kilometers across, attached by adjustable shrouds to the mass that would be the ship proper. In fact, with an albedo of one, Blaine sketched rapidly. The light sail would need about 8 million square kilometers of area. If circular, it would be about 3,000 clicks across. It was using light for thrust, so Blaine called up the intruder's deceleration, matched it to the total reflected light, divided. So, sail and payload together massed about 450,000 kilograms. That didn't sound dangerous. In fact, it didn't sound like a working spacecraft. Not one that could cross 35 light-years in normal space. The alien pilots would go mad with so little room, unless they were tiny, or liked enclosed spaces, or had spent the past several hundred years living in inflated balloons with filmy, lightweight walls. No. There was too little known and too much room for speculation. Still, there was nothing better to do. He fingered the knot on his nose. Blaine was about to clear the screens, then thought again and increased the magnification. He stared at the result for a long time, then swore softly. The intruder was heading straight into the sun. MacArthur decelerated at nearly 3 gravities directly into orbit around Bridget. Then she descended into the protective Langston field of the base on the moonlet, a small black dart sinking toward a tremendous black pillow, the two joined by a thread of intense white. Without the field to absorb the energy of thrust, the main drive would have burned enormous craters into the snowball moon. The fueling station crew rushed to their tasks. Liquid hydrogen, electrolyzed from the mushy ice of Bridget and distilled after liquefaction, poured into MacArthur's tankage complexes. At the same time, Sinclair drove his men outside. Crewmen swarmed across the ship to take advantage of low gravity with the ship dirtside. Bosuns screamed at supply masters as Bridget was stripped of spare parts. "Commander Frenzy requests permission to come aboard, sir," the watch officer called. Rod grimaced. "Send him up." He turned back to Sally Fowler, seated demurely in the watch midshipman's seat. "But don't you understand, we'll be accelerating at high G's all the way to intercept. You know what that feels like now. Besides, it's a dangerous mission."
"Pooh. Your orders were to take me to New Scotland," she huffed. "They said nothing about stranding me on a snowball."
"Those were general orders. If Chillard known we'd have to fight, he'd never have let you aboard. As captain of this ship, it's my decision, and I say I'm not about to take Senator Fowler's niece out to a possible battle."
"Oh."
She thought for a moment. The direct approach hadn't worked.
"Rod, listen, please. You see this as a tremendous adventure, don't you? How do you think I feel? Whether those are aliens or just lost colonists trying to find the Empire again, this is my field. It's what I was trained for, and I'm the only anthropologist aboard. You need me."
"We can do without. It's too dangerous."
"You're letting Mr. Barry stay aboard?"
"Not letting. The Admiralty specifically ordered me to keep him in my ship. I don't have discretion about him, but I do about you and your servants."
"If it's Adam and Annie you're worried about, we'll leave them here. They couldn't take the acceleration anyway. But I can take anything you can, Captain, my Lord Roderick Blaine. I've seen you after a hyperspace jump, dazed, staring around, not knowing what to do, and I was able to leave my cabin and walk up here to the bridge. So don't tell me how helpless I am.
Now, are you going to let me stay here, or what? Or nothing, of course. I know I can't threaten you. Please, Rod. She tried everything, including batting her eyes, and that was too much because Rod burst out laughing.
Commander Frenzy, sir, the Marine sentry outside the bridge companionway announced.
Come in, Romeo, come in,
Rod said more heartily than he felt. Frenzy was 35, a good 10 years older than Blaine, and Rod had served under him for 3 months of the most miserable duty he could ever recall. The man was a good administrator, but a horrible ship's officer. Frenzy peered around the bridge, his jaw thrust forward.
Ah, Blaine, where's Captain Schiller?
On New Chicago, Rod said pleasantly. I'm Master of MacArthur now. He swiveled so that Frenzy could see the four rings on each sleeve. Frenzy's face became more craggy, his lips drooped.
Congratulations.
Long pause.
Sir.
Thanks, Romeo. Still takes getting used to myself.
Well, I'll go out and tell the troops not to hurry about the fueling, shall I?
Frenzy said. He turned to go. What the hell do you mean, not to hurry? I've got a AA1 priority. Want to see the message?
I've seen it. They relayed a copy through my station, Blaine. Captain. But the message makes it clear that Admiral Cranston thinks Chiller is still in command of MacArthur. I respectfully suggest, sir, that he would not have sent this ship to intercept a possible alien if he knew that her master was a young officer with his first command, sir.
Before Blaine could answer, Sally spoke.
I've seen the message, Commander, and it was addressed to MacArthur, not Chiller, and it gives the ship refueling priority.
Frenzy regarded her coldly.
Lermontov will be quite adequate for this intercept, I think. If you'll excuse me, Captain, I must get back to my station.
He glared at Sally again.
I didn't know they were taking females out of uniform as midshipmen. I happen to be Senator Fowler's niece and aboard this ship under Admiralty orders, Commander,
she told him sternly.
I am astonished at your lack of manners. My family is not accustomed to such treatment, and I am certain my friends at court will be shocked to find that an Imperial officer could be so rude.
Frenzy blushed and looked around wildly.
My apologies, my lady. No insult intended, I assure you. I was merely surprised we don't very often see girls aboard warships, certainly not young ladies, as attractive as you, I beg your pardon.
His voice trailed off, still without punctuation, as he withdrew from the bridge.
Now why couldn't you react like that?
Sally wondered aloud. Rod grinned at her, then jumped from his seat. He'll signal Cranston that I'm in command here. We have, what, about an hour for a message to get to New Scotland? Another for it to get back? Rod stabbed at the intercom controls. All hands, this is the captain. Lift off in 125 minutes. Lift off in 125 minutes. If you're not aboard, we'll leave you behind.
That's the way, Sally shouted as encouragement. Let him send his messages.
While Blaine turned to hurry his crew along, she left the bridge to go hide in her cabin. Rod made another call. Commander Sinclair, let me know if there's any delay out there. If Frenzy slowed him down, Blaine just might be able to get him shot. He'd certainly try. Long ago, he'd daydreamed of having Frenzy shot. The reports came in. Cargill came onto the bridge with a sheaf of transfer orders and a satisfied look. MacArthur's bosuns, copies of the priority message in hand, had gone looking for the best men on Bridget. New crew and old hands swarmed around the ship, yanking out damaged equipment and hurriedly thrusting in spares from Bridget's supply depot, running checkout procedures and rushing to the next job. Other replacement parts were stored as they arrived. Later, they could be used to replace Sinclair's melted-looking jury rigs. If anyone could figure out how... It was difficult enough telling what was inside one of those standardized black boxes. Rod spotted a microwave heater and routed it to the wardroom. Cargill would like that. When the fueling was nearly finished, Rod donned his pressure suit and went outside. His inspection wasn't needed, but it helped crew morale to know that the old man was looking over everyone's shoulder. While he was out there,
Rod looked for the intruder. The face of God stared at him across space. The coal sack was a nebular mass of dust and gas, small as such things go, 24 to 30 light-years thick, but dense, and close enough to New Caledonia to block off a quarter of the sky. Earth and the imperial capital, Sparta, were forever invisible on its other side. The spreading blackness hid most of the empire, but it made a fine velvet backdrop for two close, brilliant stars. Even without that backdrop, Murkison's eye was the brightest star in the sky, a great red giant 35 light-years distant. The white fleck at one edge was a yellow dwarf companion star, smaller and dimmer and less interesting, the Moat. Here the coal sack had the shape of a hooded man, head and shoulders, and the off-centered red supergiant became a watchful, malevolent eye. The face of God. It was a famous sight throughout the empire, this extraordinary view of the coal sack from New Cal. But standing here in the cold of space, it was different. In a picture, it looked like the coal sack. Here, it was real. And something he couldn't see was coming at him out of the moat in God's eye. 6. The Light Sail. One gravity only, with queasy sensations as MacArthur lined up on her proper interception course. Elastic webbing held him in the acceleration chair during these few moments of changing but normal gravity. Minutes, Rod suspected, that he'd soon look back on with wistful longing. Kevin Renner had been mate of an interstellar trading vessel before joining MacArthur as her sailing master. He was a lean man with a narrow face, and he was 10 years older than Blaine. As Rod steered his acceleration chair up behind him, Renner was matching curves in a view screen, and his self-satisfied grin was not the expression of a Navy man. "Got our course, Lieutenant Renner?" "Yes, sir," Kevin Renner said with relish. "Right into the sun at 4 G's. Blaine gave in to the desire to call his bluff. "Move her." The warning alarms sounded, and MacArthur accelerated. Crew and passengers felt their weight settle gradually deeper into beds and chairs and couches, and they nerved themselves for several days of weighing far too much. "You were joking, weren't you?" Blaine asked. The sailing master looked at him quizzically. "You knew we were dealing with a light sail propulsion system, sir." "Naturally." "Then look here." Renner's nimble fingers made a green curve on the view screen, a parabola rising sharply at the right. Sunlight per square centimeter falling on a light sail decreases as the square of the distance from the star. Acceleration varies directly as the sunlight reflected from the sail. "Of course, Mr. Renner, make your point." Renner made another parabola, very like the first, but in blue. "The stellar wind can also propel a light sail. Thrust varies about the same way. The important difference is that the stellar wind is atomic nuclei. They stick where they hit the sail. The momentum is transferred directly, and it's all radial to the sun." "You can't tack against it," Blaine realized suddenly. "You can tack against the light by tilting the sail, but the stellar wind always thrusts you straight away from the sun." "Right. So, Captain, suppose you were coming into a system at 7% of the speed of light, God forbid, and you wanted to stop. What would you do?" "Drop all the weight I could," Blaine mused. "I don't see how it'd be a problem. They must have launched the same way." "I don't think they did. They're moving too fast. But pass that for a minute. What counts is they're moving too fast to stop unless they get very close to the sun. Very close indeed. The intruder is in fact diving right into the sun. Probably it will tack hard after the sunlight has decelerated it enough, provided the vessel hasn't melted and the shrouds haven't parted or the sail ripped. But it is such a close thing that they simply have to skydive. They have no choice." "Ah," said Blaine. "One need hardly mention," Renner added, "that when we match course with them, we too will be moving straight toward the sun." "At 7% of the speed of light?" "At 6. The intruder will have slowed somewhat by then. It will take us 125 hours, doing 4 G's most of the way, slowing somewhat near the end.
That's going to be hard on everybody, Blaine said. And suddenly he wondered, belatedly, if Sally Fowler had in fact gotten off. Especially the passengers. Couldn't you give me an easier course?
Yes, sir, Renner said instantly. I can pull alongside in 170 hours without ever going over 2.5 G's, and save some fuel, too, because the probe will have more time to slow down. The course we're on now gets us to New Ireland with dry tanks, assuming we take the intruder under tow.
Dry tanks. But you liked this course better.
Rod was learning to dislike the sailing master and his grin that constantly implied that the captain had forgotten something crucial and obvious.
Tell me why, he suggested.
It occurred to me the intruder might be hostile.
Yes, so?
If we were to match courses with him and he disabled the engines, we'd be falling into the sun at 6% of light speed,
right.
So you match us up as far from Cal as possible to leave time to do something about it.
Yes, sir. Exactly.
Right.
You're enjoying this, aren't you, Mr. Renner?
I wouldn't have missed it for anything, sir. What about you?
Carry on, Mr. Renner.
Blaine guided his acceleration chair to another screen and began checking the sailing master's course. Presently, he pointed out that the sailing master could give them nearly an hour at 1G just before intercept, thereby giving everyone a chance to recuperate. Renner agreed with idiot enthusiasm and went to work on the change.
I can use friends aboard my ship, Captain Chiller used to tell his midshipmen, but I'd sell them all for a competent sailing master.
Renner was competent. Renner was also a smartass. But that was a good bargain. Rod would settle for a competent smartass.
At 4 gravities, nobody walked. Nobody lifted anything. The black box replacements in the hold stayed there, while MacArthur ran on Sinclair's makeshifts. Most of the crew worked from their cots, or from mobile chairs, or didn't work at all. In crew sections, they played elaborate word games, or speculated on the coming encounter, or told stories. Half the screens on the ship showed the same thing, a disk like the sun, with Murkison's eye behind it, and the coal sack as background. The telltales in Sally's cabin showed oxygen consumption. Rod said words of potent and evil magic under his breath. He almost called her then, but postponed it. He called Barry instead. Barry was in the G-bath, a film of highly elastic mylar over liquid. Only his face and hands showed above the curved surface. His face looked old. It almost showed his true age.
Captain, you chose not to put me off on Bridget. Instead, you are taking a civilian into possible combat. Might I ask why?
Of course, Mr. Barry. I supposed it would be most inconvenient for you to be stranded on a ball of ice with no assured transportation. Perhaps I was mistaken.
Barry smiled, or tried to. Every man aboard looked twice his age, with 4 times gravity pulling down on the skin of his face. Barry's smile was like weightlifting.
No, Captain, you were not mistaken. I saw your orders in the wardroom.
So, we are on our way to meet a non-human spacecraft. It certainly looks that way. Perhaps they will have things to trade, especially if they come from a non-terrestrial world. We can hope.
Captain, would you keep me posted on what is happening?
I will probably not have the time, Blaine said, choosing the most civil of several answers that occurred to him.
Yes, of course, I didn't mean personally. I only want access to information on our progress.
At my age, I dare not move from this rubber bathtub for the duration of our voyage. How long will we be under 4 G's?
125 hours. 124 now.
Thank you, Captain.
Barry vanished from the screen.
Rod rubbed thoughtfully at the knot on his nose. Did Barry know his status aboard MacArthur? It couldn't be important. He called Sally's cabin. She looked as if she hadn't slept in a week or smiled in years. Blaine said, Hello, Sally. Sorry you came.
I told you I can take anything you can take, Sally said calmly.
She gripped the arms of her chair and stood up. She let go and spread her arms to show how capable she was.
Be careful, Blaine said, trying to keep his voice steady. No sudden moves. Keep your knees straight. You can break your back just sitting down. Now stay erect, but reach behind you. Get both the chair arms in your hands before you try to bend at the waist.
She didn't believe it was dangerous. Not until she started to sit down. Then the muscles in her arms knotted, panic flared in her eyes, and she sat much too abruptly, as if MacArthur's gravity had sucked her down. Are you hurt?
No, she said. Only my pride.
Then you stay in that chair, damn your eyes. Do you see me standing up? You do not, and you won't.
All right.
She turned her head from side to side. She was obviously dizzy from the jolt. Did you get your servants off?
Yes, I had to trick them. They wouldn't have gone without my baggage.
She laughed an old woman's laugh. I'm wearing everything I own until we get to New Caledonia. Tricked them, did you? The way you tricked me. I should have had Kelly put you off. Rod's voice was bitter. He knew he looked twice his age, a cripple in a wheelchair. All right, you're aboard. I can't put you off now.
But I may be able to help. I am an anthropologist.
She winced at the thought of trying to get up again.
Can I get you on the intercom?
You'll get the MIDI of the watch. Tell him if you really need to talk to me. But Sally, this is a warship. These aliens may not be friendly. For God's sake, remember that. My watch officers haven't time for scientific discussion in the middle of a battle.
I know that. You might give me credit for a little sense.
She tried to laugh.
Even if I don't know better than to stand up at 4 G's.
Yeah. Now do me another favor. Get into your G-bath.
Do I have to take my clothes off to use it?
Blaine couldn't blush. There wasn't enough blood flowing to his head. It's a good idea, especially if you've got buckles. Turn off the vision pickup on the phone.
Right.
And be careful. I could send one of the married ratings to help.
No, thank you.
Then wait. We'll have a few minutes of lower G at intervals. Don't get out of that chair alone in high G. She didn't even look tempted. One experience was enough.
Lermontov's calling again,
Whitbread announced. Forget it. Don't acknowledge.
Aye, aye, sir. Do not acknowledge.
Rod could guess what the cruiser wanted. Lermontov wanted first crack at the intruder. But MacArthur's sister ship wouldn't even get close to the aliens before the approach to the sun was just too close. Better to intercept out where there was some room. At least, that's what Rod told himself. He could trust Whitbread and the communications people. Lermontov's signals wouldn't be in the log. 3.5 days. 2 minutes of 1.5 G every 4 hours to change the watch, grab forgotten articles, shift positions. Then the warning horns sounded. The jolt meters swung over, and too much weight returned. At first, MacArthur's bow had pointed 60 degrees askew of Cal. They had to line up with the intruder's course. With that accomplished, MacArthur turned again. Her bow pointed at the brightest star in the heavens. Cal began to grow. He also changed color, but minutely. No one would notice that blue shift with the naked eye. What the men did see in the screens was that the brightest star had become a disk, and was growing hourly. It didn't grow brighter because the screens kept it constant, but the tiny sun disk grew ominously larger, and it lay directly ahead. Behind them was another disk of the same color, the white of an F8 star. It, too, grew hourly larger. MacArthur was sandwiched between two colliding suns. On the second day, Staley brought a new midshipman up to the bridge, both moving in traveling acceleration chairs. Except for a brief interview on Bridget, Rod hadn't met him. Gavin Potter, a 16-year-old boy from New Scotland. Potter was tall for his age. He seemed to hunch in upon himself, as if afraid to be noticed. Blaine thought Potter was merely being shown about the ship, A good idea, since if the intruder turned out hostile, the boy might have to move about MacArthur with total familiarity, possibly in darkness and variable gravity. Staley obviously had more in mind. Blaine realized they were trying to get his attention. "Yes, Mr. Staley?"
"This is Midshipman Gavin Potter, sir," Staley said. "He's told me something I think you ought to hear."
"All right, go ahead." Any diversion from high gravity was welcome.
"There was a church in our streets, sir, in a farm town on New Scotland." Potter's voice was soft and low, and he spoke carefully so that he blotted out all but a ghostly remnant of the brogue that made Sinclair's speech so distinctive.
"A church," Blaine said encouragingly. "Not an Orthodox church, I take it?"
"No, sir. A church of him. There aren't many members. A friend and I snuck inside once for a joke."
"Did you get caught?"
"I know I'm telling this badly, sir. The thing is, there was a big blow-up of an old hollow of Murchison's eye against the coal sack. The face of God, just like on postcards.
Only it was different in this picture."